are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. Hey, folks, welcome to the show, whoever you are and wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Those of you joining us for the very first time, welcome aboard. I am delighted you're here, and you're going to be delighted as well, I am sure. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman, and it's always a real mind-expanding experience to have him with us. Did you see the news? In Vietnam, a UFO exploded. Really? A UFO? Now, what I'm reading here is from, I'm looking at an article from Reuters, which is, of course, a very well-respected news agency. And no tongue-in-cheek, no chuckle, they say an unidentified flying object exploded in midair over a southern Vietnamese island. State media said Wednesday, a day after Cambodia's Air Force retracted a report of a mysterious plane crash. Now, it's an interesting thing because the people saw it, villagers saw it, it exploded, and there were pieces of it laying around, and there's even a picture of maybe that's an Air Force uniform. I don't know if that's Cambodia's or if that's Vietnam's, but anyway, the guy's carrying a piece of the metal, and it looks pretty strange, pretty interesting. Now, I put a link to that story on the site, so at kevinsmithshow.com, if you just scroll down a little bit, you know there's the little article there about tonight's show, and right below that, there is a link to this article so that you can take a look at the picture. Now, I would like to have put the picture on my website, but I suspect it is copyrighted, and I could not do that. But there it is. There is the story, and there is the picture of this guy in a uniform carrying a piece of this UFO. Now, what had happened, a guy by the name of Kung Moni, who is the deputy commander of Cambodia's Air Force, said that he had been on Tuesday. He said, well, I was told of a foreign plane crashing in the Kampot province, but then later he backed off of the claims that it was an aircraft accident. Now, that's kind of different, isn't it? I mean, the way that Stephenville thing went, we had our Air Force saying, oh, it wasn't us. We had no airplanes up there. Oop, yes, we did. We actually did have airplanes there. So their story put the airplanes there, and here this guy, who's the deputy commander of Cambodia's Air Force, takes the airplane out of the picture and says, nope, there was no aircraft accident. The way this was reported is completely without chuckle and hilarity. It's just straight reporting. It's an interesting incident. It is that. But the reporting, the way it's reported, you read it. I put a link there on the site. You read it, and you tell me what you think about it. The way it's reported, is the way I have been calling for media to report these things, and that is just report it. Don't give us any of that silly nonsense that we usually get with it. Just report it. Just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts.
There's a war out there, old friend. A world war. And it's not about who's got the most bullets. It's about who controls the information. What we see and hear, how we work, what we think. It's all about the information.
Most of the great music you hear right here on Steeleye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com.
Alien Seeker News has blasted off and is providing a new and important resource for everyone interested in UFOs, aliens, alien abductions, Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and more. Featuring five of the top UFO radio talk shows, lots of information and articles in free forums, Alien Seeker News has launched on its journey to greatness. Go to AlienSeekerNews.com, register for the free forums, and get the classic Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe as a free ebook. Join today. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steeleye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com. Did you know the Kevin Smith Show selects one of its very best shows each week and turns it into a free podcast? Well, it's true. You can download free Kevin Smith Show podcasts right now and get a free fresh podcast each week. Do you want to start building your own library of Kevin Smith Shows? All you have to do is visit our website at kevinsmithshow.com and click the free podcast link. They're yours for the download. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman, and he's been with us, of course, many times before. We're delighted to have him back with us again. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be on again. Makes the world interesting to do radio.
Yeah, especially where you are, and it's 11 o'clock at night.
That's right.
Yeah, you stayed up late for us, and we appreciate it. Just before we get into the discussion of your new book, because it truly contains some interesting perspectives and information, I was talking in the introduction, and I don't know if you caught it, but I was talking about a report from Reuters press agency that hit today, reporting that a UFO had exploded over Vietnam. At first, it exploded actually over an island that belongs to Vietnam, but it's near the Cambodian coast, and the people in Cambodia saw it and heard it. People on the island saw it and heard it.
And at first, the Cambodian deputy commander of the Air Force said, well, I heard about a foreign plane that supposedly crashed. Well, then he retracted his statement without comment. And he retracted it and said, that's not accurate. And I put a link on my website right under the little article about you. And if people click that link, it will take them to the story. There's a picture of a guy in a uniform carrying a piece of the metal from this UFO. And it's quite interesting. And there's no chuckle in it, Stanton. There's no, you know, none of that hilarious tongue-in-cheek nonsense that they usually put in these kind of reports. It's just straight reporting. Really, and
How did we hear about it?
I applaud Reuters for doing that. I'm sorry, what did you say?
Well, how did they hear about it? It was a press release out of Cambodia or Vietnam?
Their press office in Hanoi picked up on it from the state. It was being reported by the Vietnamese state media.
State media? Oh, well, sure. What else is there?
Yeah.
That's very interesting. And, I mean, obviously there are political questions over there and if there are spy planes in the wrong place and all that sort of thing. But it sounds like this was during the day, a public event, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way it's reported. And that's an interesting story, and especially since they've obviously recovered some of the pieces. And, you know, we'll just have to wait and see what that turns out to be. But what was interesting to me was that Reuters did it straight. And that's...
That is interesting.
It's encouraging.
You know, the tone in the last couple of weeks, there was an article in the New York Times from England belittling UFOs and the MOD files prove there's nothing to them. And, you know, it's in the New York Times now, echoing an English paper, a woman named Lyle, I believe. And it was really bad journalism. You know, they can't play anything straight. And there's been a lot of discussion the past 2 weeks about the MOD stuff, the Ministry of Defense in England. And I've been going back and forth on it because there's a crucial point here. It may well be, and based on those who have looked at the MOD files that are being slowly, over the next 3 years, put on the National Archives, at the National Archives in England, so that people can do their Freedom of Information Act requests through the archives and pay for copies and all that sort of stuff, rather than bothering the MOD people. That's basically the reason for it, because they got more requests for UFO stuff than on any other subject. They hate wasting their time on this junk, you know. That's the tone. And so there's been a long discussion about what it means that there's not a lot of exciting stuff in the MOD files. And there are two Englishmen, Dave Clark and Joe McGonigal, who have been involved in getting this stuff put up for the public to be able to see, who say, well, that proves they're not hiding anything. There's no smoking gun. There's no secret information. They really weren't interested in UFOs. And to me, that's a very short-sighted view, because we have the parallel in the United States of Project Blue Book. Blue Book files have been available, really, since the 70s, 12,000 reports. And we know that the important stuff didn't go to Blue Book on the basis of General Carol Bolander's statement that reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with two regulations, JNAP, Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146, or Air Force Manual 55-11, and are not part of the Blue Book system. That's what he said, this general, and I talked with him, and certainly what he said. I have a copy of the memo. Way back in 1969, the memo led to the closure of Project Blue Book. So everybody thought that Blue Book files were it. That was the only government group. And, you know, nothing terribly exciting, and we found no evidence of a threat to the security of the United States. Very carefully weasel-worded, I might say, their final comments. So we've had this discussion going with the Brits, who say, well, nothing there, nothing exciting. And I have to point out to them that, first of all, General Bollinger's memo clearly establishes Blue Book wasn't the only channel for UFO reports. Secondly, we know that many other intelligence agencies were gathering data on flying saucers, on UFOs, on anomalous aerial phenomena, whatever you want to call them, it doesn't much matter. Uncorrelated targets is what the Air Defense Command called them. That doesn't sound like flying saucer, but it certainly would be covered. It's sneaky, you know. But since we know that the CIA had big files after denying they had any, we know that the FBI had big files after J. Edgar Hoover himself denied that they had any. We know that the NSA had big files after never saying anything about them. We know that the OSI had big files, Office of Special Investigations of the Air Force. There is some indication that the Office of Naval Intelligence, although they won't tell you anything about UFOs, even when you show them one of their own reports. Thank you. As I told you, we don't have any UFO information. That's what I got told. I sent him a document that has the Office of Naval Intelligence name on it. But no, we don't have anything. So we're going around with these guys in England. It's clear the MOD didn't have any interest, and I tried to point out that every government is concerned about violations of its airspace. I think we can say that around the world.
Sure, that's part of what they're hired to do.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not Liechtenstein, who's going to care, you know, or Monaco or places like that, but and that being the case, you monitor the skies with sophisticated equipment so that if something does happen, your airspace is penetrated and enemy comes to attack, a la Pearl Harbor or whatever, you can respond immediately with appropriate military force. Now, you don't do that by somebody calling a number at a desk that's manned maybe 20% of the time and hoping he'll get back to you next week to get more information, or by sending something by mail. In other words, Blue Book did not have a role in national defense. It wasn't even on the distribution list for those reports which could affect national security. So I can't imagine any reason for anybody to think that in England, which after all has sophisticated radar systems and interceptors ready to pop into the sky to attack any intruder, and has intelligence agencies, MI5, MI6, and incidentally, those intelligence agencies are not covered by their Freedom of Information Act law over there. So I can't imagine why anybody would think that we've got all there is and there isn't any more, and because this one office wasn't excited, just like Blue Book wasn't, that therefore there isn't anything more. And is somebody going to tell me that they don't have any black budget agencies, too? I mean, the United States spends tens of billions a year on stuff that the public doesn't know about. That's the name of the game, you know, black budget.
Well, yeah, and, but, you know, even in Blue Book, you know, it's an official admission that there are unidentified aerial objects. Because
yeah,
they admit that there were a certain number that they simply could not identify. And so it's an official...
Over 600, trivial. You know, if I said there were only 600 cures for cancer, you'd say, well, I guess there isn't any cure, wouldn't you?
Yeah, so there you go. Over 600 that they could not identify, meaning these are UFOs. Now,
well, yeah.
People ascribe strange definitions to that term, UFO.
Yeah.
Some may be off-world extraterrestrial craft. Some may, if they had the ability to identify them, have been identified as something terrestrial. But the point is, do UFOs exist? Absolutely, and the government has admitted it officially.
Yes, of course. But, you know, the point you make is an important one, and I start my new book, which is Flying Saucers and Science, not UFOs and Science, because I'm interested in flying saucers. I'm not interested in UFOs. I make the very important distinction between those sightings that can be identified, which should more properly be called IFOs once you're finished looking and you've identified it, and those which can't be identified. And the question, of course, is whether there are any of the latter. And I have a whole chapter focused on the large-scale scientific studies that somehow never get mentioned by the debunkdom kings, the people who say there isn't any evidence. And you keep looking, well, where's the reference to Blue Book Special Report 14? Where's the reference to the congressional hearings? Where's the reference to J. Allen Hynek's book? Where's the reference to Dick Hall's The UFO Evidence? And you can't find these. And yet these guys have the gall to say there is no evidence. And so that's why there's a whole chapter that deals with those and gets rid of this mythology that there's nothing to UFOs besides, tabloid stuff and easily identified sightings and hoaxes and stuff like that. That's the impression you get. And, you know, there was an illustration on the Dateline program a couple weeks back. They picked 10 cases, and I wouldn't quarrel with their choice of interesting cases. And they had serious researchers like Dr. Bruce Maccabee and Philip Imbrogno and a couple of other people, Maranto from Chicago and others, who do serious investigations, spend a lot of time, money, and effort trying to get the facts, trying to find witnesses, trying to correlate it, withhold judgment until they have a lot of information. And I also had a debunker on each case. And the debunker's rules were, do your research by proclamation.
Well, that's their usual means.
That's right. And there was such a contrast on the program. I mean, Bruce Maccabee once pointed out that one of the basic rules, I have my four, but he's got one that's really good. If the first explanation doesn't work, try a second. If that doesn't work, try a third. And if that doesn't work, try a fourth, because we know that these things can't be anything but conventional or hoaxes. Now, that's not science, for goodness sakes. That's irrationality. That's bias. That's prejudice. That's ignorance. That's nasty, noisy negativism, as I like to call it. I mean, somebody's got to say what it is. And it's one of the things where I differ from some of the people in the field. I mean, my boss tolerates me because I'm my own boss. I don't need to worry about losing a job. You know, I'm self-employed sometimes.
Sometimes. So am I sometimes.
And so I can call them as I see them. And so I am not an apologist ufologist in the book. And I'm not a closet ufologist. And I say quite plainly that I am convinced on the basis of 50 years of study and investigation that some, underlying 27 times, some UFOs are alien spacecraft, and that we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate. Now, that doesn't mean that all UFOs are alien spacecraft, and it certainly doesn't mean that everybody in the government knows what's going on. Because the basic rule for security is, A, you need an appropriate clearance, and B, you have to have a need to know. And having the clearance doesn't get you a need to know. That's where the argument's going on with these guys in England. Well, they haven't seen anything that indicates the MOD, Ministry of Defense, was even seriously interested. Well, I'm not saying they were, but I'm saying what makes you think there isn't another group like Majestic 12, or the NSA, or the CIA, or the DIA, or the NRO, all these other alphabet soup agencies, who are doing their thing. Like I say, you don't expect the UFO desk, which is where the public reports things, to respond on the military side of things. I mean, I'll admit that in the early 50s, the United States was so ill-prepared for possible attacks from the Soviet Union because we thought they were a bunch of dumb peasants and it'd be years before they had nuclear weapons and weapons methods for delivering them. They set up the Ground Observer Corps. We're going to station people at high places and they'll have numbers to call if they see an approaching Soviet airplane. You know, that's not very clever national defense. I'm sure the Brits are doing better than that, and that there were people hooked into the sophisticated systems, not Joe Blow standing out on a street corner. And that's what General Bolander meant. Reports which could affect national security will continue to be made in accordance with the regulations established for that purpose, even though the public won't have a place to report UFO sightings if we close Project Blue Book, which is what that was all about, and it was closed as a result of this. And so it's important to recognize that governments have the ability to cover up. And, you know, people look at me, well, isn't it all that stuff automatically declassified after X years or Y years? No, it is not. Some stuff is. Who cares? You know, it's like your latest computer from 1962 is probably not a very sophisticated system compared to what we have today. So if it was classified then, there's no point in keeping it classified now. But that doesn't mean other things aren't kept classified. So, you know, it's an ongoing discussion, but, and that I go into in the book because, you know, it's one thing for me or anybody else to say, oh, the government's covering up. I show that it's covering up by showing some of the blacked out documents from the CIA and the NSA and stuff like that, and then by quoting their own lies. And, you know, on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, I have a paper called Government UFO Lies. And I enunciate with specific data and evidence that they're lying. I mean, like the FBI lied to me when it said it didn't have a file on me. I mean, I told them that I had had a security clearance. I knew that they had done the investigation. And I asked for all files on me, gave them all my background and all that stuff. We don't have a file on you, they said. Then I heard from the CIA where I'd made the same request, and they said, all we have on you is a negative name check request from the FBI, and here's the file number. So I went back to the FBI, and, oh, yes, so we rechecked, and we found we do have a file on you, but it's classified. And I asked for the level of security and the size of the file. Sorry, that information is classified too. So they start out by lying, flat out lying. They get caught, and now they say, well, we can't tell you anything about you, you know, not even the size of the file. And I resented that because they told Bill Moore the size of his file years ago.
Well, you know, there was a time back in the late 60s and early 70s when the impression that one got from all the news reports was that, you know, if the FBI didn't have a file on you, you were a real nobody. They were keeping files on everybody.
Well, like I said, I had a clearance for 14 years. You get a clearance or renewal, if you will, a reinvestigation every 5 years. So 1, 5, and 9 it was every 4 years, I guess, they investigated me. So that's standard. That's par for the course. You fill out forms if you join any organizations that they might not like, you know, and stuff like that. And as a matter of fact, before I got my first clearance, they checked out my wife. That's part of the game. So yeah, it's not surprising that they would have a file on me. What's irksome is that they lied about it and then wouldn't tell me the size or the security level of the file. And Larry Bryant, who's a hard-digging guy in a Washington area, who's got guts and going after government stuff, he got some of my files, and they even had wrong information. They had what he got was my passport file. And at one point, they had me being my own brother.
Oh, now that's an interesting trick.
Yeah, my whole name is Stanton Terry Friedman. And at one point, when I was in school and young, everybody called me Terry. But at one point, they have Terry is Stanton's brother. These guys are really competent, aren't they?
I wouldn't say that was. Okay, we are into a break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. More with Stanton Friedman. We're going to be talking about, I almost said UFOs. We're going to be talking about flying saucers
and science, not fiction, not science fiction, flying saucers and science. Don't go away. We're talking with Stanton Friedman this evening, and he's got a new book out. The topic of that book, the subject of that book, is what we are discussing here tonight, flying saucers and science.
Stanton, let's focus on that just a bit. We've mentioned it, we've brushed against it, but what is the deal? What are you talking about in this new book?
Well, I have a whole chapter on all the evidence that you can't get into one lecture or one radio program, the large-scale scientific studies that are totally ignored as if they didn't exist by the noisy negativists and even by some of the positivists. So I got a whole chapter on those, giving chapter and verse from Blue Book Special Report 14 and other studies and raising the objections and then demolishing them, showing, for example, that the data shows the better the quality of the sighting, the more likely to be unexplainable, which is just the reverse of what the noisy negativists try to say.
Why is that? Why is it if we have a better quality of a sighting and better quality of report, why is it more likely that we can't identify it?
Well, because we call it good quality because it's observed for a long time by competent observers under good circumstances. So you'd expect, in other words, a hypothetical question. If some UFOs were alien spacecraft, then one would expect that the better the quality of the sighting, the more likely to be unexplainable. In other words, because it was observed for 5 minutes instead of 5 seconds, and from 50 yards instead of 500 yards, and by a physicist, a pilot, and a priest, let's say, then we would expect, if you called it a high-quality sighting, it was because those people should have been able to recognize anything conventional. And yet, my University of Chicago classmate, Carl Sagan, I got to say that every program, you know, just to rub it into Carl, I guess. We were classmates for 3 years, and he said on more than one occasion in one book and publicly in a newspaper and other places that there are interesting sightings that aren't reliable, which is true. There are reliable sightings that aren't interesting, which is also true, but then he jumped to the conclusion that there are no interesting and reliable sightings, no sightings that are both interesting and reliable. That's totally false. In Blue Book Special Report 14, 35% of the excellent cases were unexplainable. Only 18% of the poor cases. It's what you'd expect if unknowns are really something different, which is, of course, the question. And so that's one of the big myths. Another is about duration of observation. The myth being, oh, UFOs are only observed for a short period of time, a few seconds by incompetent observers. Well, if you look at the duration of observation, you find that, gee, the better the quality, the longer the duration of observation. That's not surprising. You ought to do a better job of identifying something or trying to if you observe it for 2 minutes as opposed to 20 seconds. The myth, they only last a short time. The reality, they last a long time. Some of them 10 minutes, 20 minutes, etc.
Well, I know of one, and I have the recording of it, that lasted for several hours. And I have the recording of the police traffic. Actually, it's the sheriff's office traffic, radio traffic, as they work this thing. And they talk about it's coming right over me. It's just above treetop level. It's gigantic. It's, you know. Now, one of the things that I hear that I really choke on, and I hear this, you mentioned it, and I hear it from the debunkers, is they are not trained observers, they are incompetent witnesses. You know, look, I'm not a doctor, right? I'm not a medical doctor. But if I see someone that's laying on the ground and has a gigantic wound to the chest, I may not know medically what's going on inside that person. I may not be able to describe that. But I am a competent observer because I've had eyes all my life. And, I know I'm looking at a wounded individual. Maybe I can't describe his medical condition in, terms that would be acceptable in a medical convention. But I can say, well, he had a tremendous wound to his chest. There was blood everywhere. He seemed to be unconscious. He was breathing. You know, I can do those kinds of things. Yeah. And an observer, if you've had eyes all your life and you observe something, you are a competent observer of that. You may not know all the scientific terminology to use, but you can describe what you saw.
Well, that's why one of the most important aspects of UFO investigation is to separate observation from interpretation. And when James McGaha, the ex-pilot, tried to say on Larry King and elsewhere, oh, they weren't competent observers, you know, he said that in a debate that he and I did. And I'll leave people who watch the tape, and copies are listed on my website at www.stanfriedman.com. Our flying saucers are real. It was at a university in Tennessee. The point is that you don't, I couldn't figure out what he meant by that, but after the last time on Larry King, finally it occurred to me, oh, they're not a trained astronomer. But do you have to be? Of course not. People said they stood in one place and watched this huge thing, maybe a mile, maybe half a mile, it doesn't matter, move over slowly. It was boomerang-shaped. It took them 4 minutes to pass over, and it blotted out the sky. And it wasn't that high up, and there were some kind of lights on the leading edge, if you will. Now, you can be a competent observer to observe that. Nobody's asking you what class of star is it, or, you know, the name of the plane. But for something like that to move slowly and silently and blot out a big chunk of the sky, you got to have eyes, as you put it. That's all you need, and you've got to be awake, I mean, alert, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the whole point. Now, I'll admit that sometimes investigators and journalists in particular get carried away. They'll try to pin the person down as to a guess as to how big and how high and how far. And then they'll report it that way when the witness always kept saying, well, I don't know. There was no way to judge. Well, the scientist sees it in the paper. Witness says the Volkswagen-sized UFO moving at 30 miles an hour, 150 yards up and 300 yards away. And the scientist laughs. And you can't tell any of those things, which is true. But if you say at what angle it was above the horizon and what you could hold at arm's length to just cover it, and for the doubting Thomases, all it takes is an aspirin tablet at arm's length to cover the moon, if you want something to judge by. People often guess it takes a quarter, but try it sometime, you know. And so what direction were you looking? These are observables. What time was it? And the crazy thing here is that the reason we can identify most sightings as relatively conventional phenomena is that people are good observers. They didn't know it was Venus, because they don't know that it's Venus sitting up there at 3 in the morning, the brightest thing in the sky. But you ask them to pin down what direction they were looking, what angle above the horizon, how did it move in the sky over a period of time, how bright was it compared to other stars that you could see, stuff like that. And you look at the star chart, oh, you were watching Venus. You can't have it both ways. People are poor observers. If they can't, we can't identify what they saw, but good observers, when we can identify. Now, which is it?
Well, let me give you a situation.
Okay.
When the photographs came back from Titan, from the Huygens probe.
Yeah, the Cassini spacecraft, little
mm-hmm,
brother. Yeah.
Yeah. So the photographs came back and. They were pretty dark, and I just used a program to put some light into the picture to take some of the darkness out and increase the contrast.
Yeah.
I did that, and then a friend of mine who is a commercial airline pilot. I was talking with him and another friend who is also a pilot, commercial airline pilot, and I said, can you tell me what is that? I didn't tell him it was from NASA. I didn't tell him it was from Titan. I just said, what is that? What do you see there? And he said, well, this looks like it was taken from an aircraft. It's an aerial shot. And he said, there's an airport right there. And he pointed it out. And he said, and there are the buildings, the towers right there. And as he pointed it out, I could see it. And the other one said the same thing. And I said, gentlemen, that's on Titan. And they both looked at each other, and the first one said to me, I don't care where it is, that's an airport.
But what would he know about airports? He's only a pilot.
Yeah. And I looked at the other one who didn't comment, and I said, if you were in the air and you saw that, would you, and you needed to land, would you head for that to land? And he said, yeah, I probably would.
Well, it's funny, this mythology about people being good or bad observers. And incidentally, the ultimate test on this is that the debunkers will tell you, well, there's no difference between the unknowns and the knowns. The unknowns are just misknowns. Well, the guys who did Blue Book Special Report 14 asked that question. They said, is there really any difference? Let's look at six observable characteristics, apparently.
Let's get into that after the break, though, because if we start, it's going to cut us off, and I don't want to chop it up that way. Are you a good observer? Do you have to be an expert?
if you see a red sports car go by, you may not know what brand, but you know it was a red sports car, right? If you see a giant bird in the sky, you might not know whether it was an eagle or a buzzard or some kind of a hawk, but you do know you saw a giant bird in the sky. I don't know. I find that whole thing that the debunkers do where they try to tap dance on the witnesses, I find it laughable. It's absolutely stupid. Every rookie cop knows better than to fall for that nonsense. We'll be back right after this. Get it all. Become a member at KevinSmithShow.com. Welcome back. I just got an email from someone who was complaining that the player just won't work. The player does work. But even if you are being charged for and you think you have broadband, you have to understand that those are sometimes not as broad as they are marketed to be, and especially if you have DSL. So if the broadband connection is not working for you, why wouldn't you click on the dial-up connection and listen with it? I don't understand why you wouldn't do that. All right, Stanton Friedman is my guest, and we're talking about science and flying saucers. Stanton, it is your position, as you've stated, you're not interested in UFOs. You're interested in flying saucers, and your definition of that term is spacecraft from elsewhere.
Extraterrestrial spacecraft, right. And what I started to say before is that the guys who did this big study, Blue Book Special Report 14, and copies are available. I don't hide any of this stuff. They're listed on the website. They ask the obvious question that a scientist would ask. Okay, we got all this data about 3,201 sightings, all kinds of information about each one, apparent size, color, shape, speed, all that sort of stuff. Let's cross-compare the unknowns, the only ones I'm interested in, and the knowns. And if there isn't anything to flying saucers, then we would expect to find, there is no difference on the average of the same size, color, shape, speed, all that sort of stuff. Well, what they found was quite the reverse. They found that the probability that the unknowns are no different from the knowns, are just misknowns, if you will, is less than 1%. And they tried all kinds of games, monkeying around, color, shape, speed, let's get rid of the astronomical ones, let's do this, let's do that. They couldn't make them fit. The unknowns were not the same as the knowns, despite the shrieks of the noisy negativists. So these are examples of scientific data never referred to by the debunkers, I might add. Now, the other chapter that gets right up to the science, you see, the two basic objections, there isn't any evidence, and if you say it enough times, maybe people will believe you, and you can't get here from there. You see, we don't need to look at the evidence. We know from basic physics. We hear from guys with piled higher and deeper, PhD degrees.
That's what I call it.
You can't get here from there. And so in the book, there actually are pictures of nuclear rockets, for example, that are never talked about by the noisy negativists. Of course, this stuff wasn't done in universities. It was done in industry or national laboratories. But I talk about nuclear rockets that I worked at and that we tested on the ground. I talk about fusion rockets that at least we did a study of and that everybody out there would know about. And people look at me when I say that. What do you mean? How do you know they would know about it? I say, because every advanced civilization will have figured out how its star produces all that energy. Now, you know, 100 years ago, it's just a mass of burning gas, the stars, and its age couldn't be very long because you figure out the energy output, and you look at the mass of the sun, you say, that couldn't have lasted very long, couldn't be very old. It wasn't until 1938, after I was born. Not, there's no connection between those two, only that's how recent it was. It wasn't until 1938 we figured out that it was nuclear fusion going on in the sun that produced the energy. See, there had to be a few little discoveries before that. First was that E equals mc squared. And C, the speed of light, is a very big number. M is the mass. And so energy equals the mass times the speed of light squared. Oh, that's a big number. The second thing that had to be discovered was the neutron, which helped make sense out of what goes on inside nuclei. And so a good physicist figured out that the sun was a fusion factory. And as a side comment, and some people get mad at me when I point this out, but I think it's important to recognize, within 14 years of that discovery, and the neutron was only discovered about 6 years earlier, but within 14 years of that discovery, we exploded our first H-bomb, which is a fusion device, using a fission device to get things going. So we know what to do when we find out very surprising, startling, exciting technology. Kill with it! That's what you do! That seems to be the Earthling attitude, wouldn't you say?
Well, that certainly is our track record. And let me just throw something in here that I was thinking about as you were talking about this chain of discoveries. Isn't it interesting, as our ability to discover smaller and smaller and smaller things, as our ability to do that has increased, the power that comes from them has increased?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's a point I make someplace in the book that as you go from the big fat atom into the small nucleus, you go down in size a factor of maybe 10,000 and up in energy a million. You know, which, don't ask me why, that's the way God created the universe, I guess, and figure you got to be sophisticated to discover what's going on. But it is quite remarkable, and I keep wondering, what happens when you get inside the quarks from which neutrons and protons are made? Do you go up in energy by this huge amount again? And, you know, to give you an example, when I say huge amount of energy, typical chemical reactions, you know, burning gasoline, let's say, per unit, you get a few electron volts. It's an amount of energy, small amount. You get a few in normal chemical reactions that we're familiar with. When you go to a fission reaction, you get 200 million electron volts of energy per reacting particle from a few, say five, small number.
Mm-hmm.
Up to 100 or 200 million electron volts. So we're not talking about, it's just a little more efficient per unit weight. It's enormously more efficient. And now some people have trouble getting their mind around that, but it's, you know, I'm a nuclear guy, and it's always impressed me that, you know, on a fusion rocket on which I worked back in the early 60s, if you use the right stuff, and there are a lot of wrong things to use, but that's true of everything, there are a lot of things you can take that won't help your disease, aren't there? It might kill you, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
But when you get to use the right isotopes, you can kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a chemical rocket. 10 million, not 10, not 100, not 1,000, 10 million times. And we're not accustomed, I guess, in everyday life to seeing such enormous differences, depending on, you know, what process you're using, what you're doing. A baseball player is a much better player if he bats 30 points higher, you know. 330 to 300 makes an enormous difference. That's a 10% increase. But we're talking here 10 million times as much energy. So it goes back to one of Friedman's laws, and I guess I repeat it in the book several times, that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. And one of the problems we have with the ancient academics and the fossilized physicists is that they can't imagine that. They think they're so smart, each generation thinks this, of course, that we've learned all there is, we know all there is to know. But if we look around a little bit and step outside of ourselves, we realize that simply isn't true. You know, I like the idea of lasers aren't better light bulbs. Well, I mean, they're two different sources of light. Isn't one just like the other? No. An atom bomb isn't just like a 10-ton blockbuster in World War II. It was the equivalent of a 10,000-ton blockbuster. And an H-bomb is another 1,000 on top of that. So we have to recognize that there are discontinuities, abrupt changes. From my slide rule to the computer I'm sitting in front of, it's not just a little faster for the computer. The typewriter sitting over there, I still have a typewriter, believe it or not, and I use it to type address labels with it. And people, pretty soon people say, what's a typewriter? You know?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you mean a printer? No, I mean a typewriter.
I actually, you know, I thought typewriters were fun. I did. I like typewriters. And I like to read things that were done on typewriters. And in fact, in police work, there was a whole science developed, you know, around identifying a specific
typewriter by the differences in the impressions, the keys. All right, we're into a break. We'll be back right after this. And when we do come back, you know what we're going to do, right? We are going to open the telephone lines for you at 1-800-289-1092.
Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
Welcome back. We are talking this evening with Stanton Friedman, and we're talking about his new book, which is Flying Saucers and Science. And
Stanton, we have callers already stacking up, so let's go to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. I'm going to make a prediction. This is Kevin from Canada. Am I correct? whoever it was hung up. 1-800-289-1092 is the number to call. The reason I said that is he has an uncanny ability to be the first caller on many nights. Anyway, whoever it was, if I scared you, I'm sorry. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, hello, it's Kevin from Air Quality.
What did I tell you, Stanton? He's got the magic touch. What's on your mind, Kevin?
First caller, man.
Yeah. Well, unless, did you just hang up?
No, I didn't.
Well, you're the second caller.
Well, so how are you doing, Stanton?
I'm doing fine here in Atlantic Canada, beautiful downtown Fredericton, New Brunswick.
Oh, right on. So, you know, Kevin Smith has mentioned about the UFOs being, you know, being a misnomer, that they're unidentified flying objects, and that what we want to know is actually who's piloting them. Who do you feel are the pilots of these flying saucers? Are they the Greys, Anunnaki, or?
Well, I think they're aliens. I think there are some Greys. I think some are from Zeta Reticuli. But, you see, my view of our neighborhood, and I stress this in the book, is that there are lots of civilizations all around about us. Mm-hmm. The city people would have you believe, hey, there's nobody nearby because we haven't picked up any signals. Like, they're so smart. And I have a whole chapter on SETI, the silly effort to investigate, is what SETI means, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's based on a whole bunch of assumptions having no reality to them. Like, we're so smart, we can figure out what their techniques for transmission are. I mean, how do we know they're not using FM and we're only listening AM, you know?
Yeah.
And furthermore, why they would transmit to us, and they also assume that you can't get here from there. Obviously, if aliens are coming here, who needs SETI? I mean, cancel the programs, learn sign language, you know.
Yeah,
but so I say aliens. I don't know. It's just like the Indians in the Caribbean, Americas, back in the 1400s, 1500s. Mm-hmm. Every time they turned around, there was somebody from another place coming to bother them. You know, there were the French, there was the Spanish, there was the English, there was the Dutch, there was the Portuguese, and there were guys to convert them, steal their land, steal their jewels, steal their gold. Guys who took some of them back with them. There were also guys who brought back potatoes and other tobacco, two important crops. I hope they didn't mix them together.
And salmon. Do you also feel that that SETI, I've always felt that SETI is nothing but a diversion. Like, it's used as a diversion to keep people away from the real extraterrestrial agenda. Do you believe that?
I think there's some truth to that. You have a group that has its own self-interest at heart and is glorified with their wonderful radio telescopes and how smart they are, and excited us. And I'll give my classmate Carl Sagan credit for doing more than anybody else to get people to be interested in extraterrestrial intelligence. But he did everything he could to keep them from looking at the UFO data. And, you know, right now we hear it, and in the book I talk in detail about the views of Seth Shostak and Jill Tarter and other Frank Drake, and point out that the Drake equation isn't really an equation, and we don't have numbers to fill in a whole bunch of the terms. And you throw darts at dartboards, it's dartboard physics.
Yep.
So, yeah, diversion is a good word for it, because instead of worrying about people landing in your backyard who might abduct you, you worry about those big, beautiful telescopes, you know, like the large, well, I remember in Contact, the very large array radio telescope down in New Mexico, in the plains of San Augustine, where there was a crash at the same time as Roswell, as a matter of fact. That was before the telescope was there. But, yeah, diversion is a good way to put it. And I'm not suggesting a conspiracy that the government is paying these guys to defocus attention from UFOs and try to focus it on the new Allen telescope in Northern California, for example, and stuff like that. You know, radio telescopes have their place. They do.
Well, yeah, but you know what? I can't for the life of me understand why, if they adopt the view that these beings using our technology could not get here because of the time and distance involved. But they've adopted that view. Then obviously, radio is, if they are coming here, they're traveling faster than the speed of light. Radio's not fast enough. And why would you look for radio waves? I mean, however they communicate, it's not by radio. That's just not fast enough. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and where are you calling from?
Yeah, this is Trey from Atlanta.
Yeah, Trey.
Yeah, listen, I wanted to ask Mr. Friedman a question. I've seen Mr. Friedman on documentaries, and I've seen him a couple, and I'm not sure exactly where these the chart was, from where the chart was. It was, I believe it might have been a blue book, and it was a study, say out of 2,000 UFO reports, that 18% were weather balloons, 12% was ball lightning, yada, 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 okay? The list I'm talking about. Anyways, what I wanted to suggest and ask you, Mr. Friedman, first I'd like to suggest that if you were to look at the eyewitness testimony interviews of these 2,000 reports, that you would probably find that what they said these objects were doing do not match those categories that they're classified in, meaning that, you know, the 18% of weather balloons, well, they didn't say that the things were just floating around. They said they were doing this, that, all kind of crazy maneuvers. Has anyone that you know of ever gone through and read these interviews and actually compared them to the these numbers that I've seen before, these percentages, and actually to see if these are really legitimate, or are these people just, you know, come up with these numbers at the chart first, and then, you know, whatever the interviewee said is irrelevant, you know, which is, you know, goes to the fact that, you know, a lot of the interviewees aren't listened to anyways and aren't taken seriously.
Well, that is an interesting question. What about that, the running the numbers
again?
Well,
I'd say yes and yes. There are these tables, the categories, and there are a couple in my book where I show in the big study, the Blue Book Special Report 14, 3,201 sightings, etc. That's the output after people have, serious investigators, in this case at Patel Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, went through all these cases. On the other hand, people have gone through the, that was back in 55, mind you, that the report was published. And the press release didn't even identify the name of the reporter who did the work, and the Secretary of the Air Force lied about the study, flat out lied. And there's an article on my website, Government UFO Lies, and that's one of them. On the other hand, there are people now, Project 1947, people named Brad Sparks and a few other people have gone through the Blue Book files, and they've been available for years. You know, we hear all this fuss about the English and the French putting their stuff out there. How about the U.S.? The Blue Book files have been available since the early 70s. But people have been going through these cases and find in case after case, just what the caller said, that the explanation wasn't derivable from the observation.
And so the numbers are skewed.
Well, yeah, I mean, the good numbers, the Blue Book Special Report 14 numbers, were before they started all the crazy manipulation. And after that, the rule was identify it any way you can. It doesn't matter whether it matches anything. And they played all kinds of tricks, and I talk about those in the report. But I should point out that Dr. James E. McDonald, whom I consider the finest ufologist that ever lived, he was a professor of physics at the University of Arizona, as a matter of fact, down in Tucson. And his specialty was atmospheric physics, and he was intrigued in the early 60s. And so he eventually wound up going to Project Blue Book and looking at case after case after case and finding a lot of very good cases. But the identifications, the description, the investigation was totally inadequate. And in his congressional testimony of 1968, July 29th, 1968, my birthday as it happens, I wasn't born in 68, but that's my birthday. His testimony had 41 separate cases, outstanding cases. And many of them had been just passed on by, casually explained away. So the caller is right that the official Blue Book files contain lots of good cases and lots of explaining away. Charismatic hand-waving, I call it. Well, it must have been a balloon. Or, that was probably Venus. Or, you know, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And if the first solution doesn't work, you try a second one. Now, I should stress, when I was talking about unknowns before, 21.5% of the 3,201 cases studied. There was a rule. No sighting could be listed as an unknown unless all four of the final report evaluators agreed it was an unknown. Any two could label it anything else. So their whole focus was to try to determine, do we really have some strange things? And it was clear that they did. 21.5%. Now, I should add, that was completely separate from the 9.2%, I guess, that were listed as insufficient information. And that's another one of the false claims by the debunkers, that the only reason sightings can't be explained is because there wasn't enough data. That is balderdash. It's false by definition, at least in the early studies where they paid some scientific attention to the data.
Well, they, in those cases, they had more data than the other cases, and that's why they couldn't explain them, right?
Well, basically, yes. And so the unknowns were, by definition, not those cases for which there was insufficient information. And yet the Secretary of the Air Force said, and I quote, on the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those publicly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. The unknowns were not 3%, they were 21.5%. They were not the cases for which there was insufficient information. That was a separate category. So one of the purposes for writing this book is to put these facts out on the table to replace the mythology. And, you know, I also, incidentally, there's a whole chapter on the UFO why questions. You know, why would aliens come here? Why would the government not tell us what it knows? Why don't they land on the White House lawn? You know, there's a whole bunch of these sorts of questions. And I wonder how many people have really done any in-depth thinking about these.
You're a funny guy. In-depth thinking is out of style, man. They don't do that anymore.
Well, the SETI people say, hey, if we discovered extraterrestrial intelligence, we would broadcast it to the world. You couldn't keep a secret like that. There's another whole chapter, the Cosmic Watergate.
Let's go to the phone line, and we'll come back to that in just a moment. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
This is Ryan in Washington State.
Hi, Ryan.
I had a question for Stanton. I've been doing a lot of reading, and I saw a theory out there that nuclear explosions could possibly cause a time warp. And I just, you're a nuclear physicist, and you know this is your specialty. And I just wonder what you thought about that theory, that possibility that when a nuclear explosion happens, that it creates a rip in space and time, and that could possibly be where some of these anomalous things are coming from, some kind of a time loss and things like that. That was my question. So.
I have no reason to think that a puny nuclear explosion, and I'll explain what I mean by puny in a minute, would cause a rip in space or time. I have every reason to believe that any alien visitors in the local neighborhood would be very much concerned by this primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare exploding nuclear weapons, especially the H-bombs, the fusion weapons. I mean, that first one that I mentioned, 1952, we discovered fusion in 38. In 1952, we built our first H-bomb, 10 million tons of TNT equivalent. Think about that for a minute. That's not the biggest one that's ever exploded. The Russians exploded one that was 50 megatons. But the point is, if you were from someplace else and you saw an explosion with a 3-mile-wide fireball, which is what that one produced, 3 miles wide, you'd be concerned about the idiots down track record in World War II. And I say this for the young people out there. We Earthlings killed 50 million of our own kind. Now, think about that. We destroyed 1,700 cities. If you were an alien, wouldn't you be concerned about these idiots?
Hey, I'm not an alien, and I'm concerned about us idiots. You know, and well, caller, just hang on for a minute. We'll bring you on the air in just a second. You know, if you can imagine, I mean, this sounds like when you describe us, it sounds like fiction, but it's not. Can you imagine people going to war over Santa Claus? You know, some people believe in Santa Claus, some don't. And then there are some people who call him Santa Claus, and there are others that call him Saint Nick, and they go to war. And I mean, it's over stuff just as stupid as that. We have a penchant for killing each other. All right. Yeah.
Our primary activity, or primitive society's major activity, is tribal warfare, I would say. But incidentally, let me finish off that bit about a rip in time.
Mm-hmm.
Just the other day, we observed, because of our new and better astronomical instruments, a supernova going off. It was 88 million light years away, and we observed it from here. Now, that might make one heck of a rip in time.
It just might. And it took 88 million years for that flash to get to us. Someone was very fortunate to be watching the right part of the sky to see that flash. All right, let's go to the phone line. And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and where are you calling from?
Yes, this is Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
I just wondered, what confuses me is that these aliens are so advanced, but yet we have so many crashed vehicles. You'd think they'd be beyond, you know, controlling their ships and crashing. Are they doing this on purpose to allow us into their technology, or what? You know, it just doesn't make sense.
I don't think so. I think bad stuff happens. We've lost two shuttles now. Anybody would have said such a sophisticated vehicle costing so much with so much technology that went into it couldn't possibly crash. But we lost two of them. And really for stupid reasons, if you remember, a piece of insulation hit in the wrong place and ice build up. I mean, I think aliens, their zero defects program is maybe not a lot better than ours. And again, if you think that there are a lot of civilizations around and there's a lot of activity, the MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, had, I think it was 490 UFO reports in the month of April. And we don't hear them all, certainly. So what I'm saying is there's a lot going on. A lot of guys coming here, or maybe gals too, I don't know. And I think we may have shot some down. I know. And I do talk about this in the book, and there's a new book called Shoot Them Down by Frank Fascino Jr., that in 1952, pilots were ordered to shoot down UFOs if they don't land when instructed to do so.
That's not too wise, is it?
Well, but, as a matter of fact,
the fact that they're advanced doesn't mean that they're perfect.
No, of course not.
You know, you can take the most advanced ocean liner and you know, just absolutely the best technology in ocean going vessels, and have a big methane bubble released from the ocean floor, and it'll sink the boat.
So will the dumb old iceberg, you may recall.
Yeah, something about a Titanic. Yeah, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin in North Carolina.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi, and Kevin, you have delivered tonight. I have to say, Stanton Friedman, it is an honor. I've been watching you
since
UFOs Are Real back in, 79 or 80, the one with
Steve
Marcel in it. And,
yes,
and I have to admit, back then, you were so cool, so confident, you seemed so knowledgeable. I said, this is a bought and paid for government guy keeping us down. I was so wrong. I don't
Another understand. One of these guys accusing me of being a government agent. My
oh,
goodness.
No, I was so wrong. So I don't have a serious question, so I'll be brief, but I want to tell you, I've said I'm going to wear this to a convention sometime if I ever go to one, but next time you're on Larry King Live, I'll buy the shirt for you. You need a T-shirt. In big letters, it says Skeptics. And then underneath it in small print says, I've heard of them, but there's no proof they really exist.
Oh, that's good.
Thanks,
hey, I'm talking to the King people, and I hope I'll be on next month. July. And, you know, you got to reach the world somehow. But, you know, it's funny. People have been saying he must be a government plant. And, of course, I get the opposite. People saying, how come you're still alive, Stan?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It really is an interesting phenomenon. People love to hear. No. People love to hear from, quote, government insiders. People who have worked on the inside, who know what's going on, they want to hear from them. And then they get suspicious of them. I've noticed that. It's just kind of an interesting phenomenon.
The two people who wrote forewords for my book, my book's unusual, I got two forewords, I'm very pleased. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, obviously was an astronaut and worked for the government, if you will. And the other one is Dr. Bruce Maccabee, who just retired after more than 35 years working for a Navy research lab. So, in a sense, they're both were government insiders, and they say nice things about my book, for which I am very grateful. But I've had people accuse me flat out. He's working for the government. He's always been an agent. Milton William Cooper, who was a strange character, said that I worked for the CIA, and so did Bruce and others. And, you know, I tell people, I did indeed work for the United States government. Wow! I worked for the U.S. Post Office for 2 weeks in 1952 in Linden, New Jersey, where I grew up, at Christmas vacation when I was a sophomore at Rutgers University. That is the extent of my government employment. Period. End of report. I never worked for anybody else in the government. I mean, like everybody else, a part of my salary always went to the government.
In the United States, that's the largest employer. There are tons of people that work for the government. Let's go back to the phone line and caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Dick from Lebanon, Indiana.
Yeah, Dick. Let me warn both of you that we do have a break coming up in about 1.5 minutes. So if we get into something and we have to take a break, we'll just flow over and continue after the break.
Okay. Hello, Stan.
Yep.
I have been wondering, what did you know of Dr. Michael Wolff?
Dr. Michael Wolff was not a doctor. He was a poor, deluded man. He was in a mental hospital. I talked to his brother. I talked to his sister. He doesn't have any of the 5 degrees he claimed he had, which included 2 PhDs in physics and an MD and a couple of other fancy degrees from fancy schools. I had a number of phone conversations with him before he announced all these special characteristics. And it's really kind of sad how some people have glommed on to him. I even talked to the guy who wound up doing the cremation, which Michael couldn't afford to pay for, even though he was supposedly a pilot, a colonel, and a big employee of the government. He was a poor, deluded man who had no degrees from anywhere. He was not married. Remember, there's a story that his wife and son died, and he set up a scholarship fund for him and all that stuff. He was never married, never had a wife or a son. I talked to people who knew him a long time ago, and he was in a mental hospital for a long time. And, you know, I normally wouldn't talk about such things, but when people have made all kinds of claims for him, I mean, those PhDs in physics weren't just from anywhere. They were from MIT and Caltech. And the medical degree was from McGill. And I checked these schools and two others that he claimed to have degrees from. Hadn't gone to any of them. And he did flunk out of Uppsala in New Jersey a long time ago, of course. But it's a sad case. He tried to out-Lazar Bob Lazar. See, Bob claimed to only have master's degrees from MIT and Caltech. Well, Michael claimed to have PhDs from both. Of course, Bob didn't go to any university and didn't have a degree from anywhere either, but... You know, if you're going to outdo somebody, pick somebody who's making big claims. What the heck?
Well, let me tell you something. Let me tell you something, Stan. I was on the AlphaCom team. I knew Dr. Wolf. And, you know, some of your bizarre stuff there, I've even read where Bob Lazar, I've seen the dossier on Bob Lazar, and okay. I've read your website.
The break is on us. Both of you hang on. We'll continue after the break, all right? All right, folks, we'll be back right after this. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com.
Call Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
We are back. My guest is Stanton Friedman, and we have a caller on the line. Dick, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm still with you. It won't take me long to finish this up, but see the problem with people like Stanton. They take him at his word. He writes all kind of BS up on his website. I knew Dr. Wolf quite well, and the people that you mentioned that said that he did not exist and all that kind of bogus stuff, that's a pile of crap. I've been fighting that all my life, and I was a member of AlphaCom. I do hold an above-top secret clearance. And Stanton, do you get any funding from the government? You did at one time.
I have never worked for the government except the United States Post Office in Linden, New Jersey, for 2 weeks delivering mail in 1952. Do I have to repeat that again? That's very clear. And if you say that these guys are what they say they are, I take it you've seen diplomas. I haven't, and I've checked five different offices at MIT, and all the people who claim that Lazar is what he says he is, they haven't checked. They haven't provided anything. Bob Lazar's good buddy, Gene Huff, called me, asked what it would take for me to be convinced that Bob was legitimate. There's no doubt Bob is bright. Michael was bright. Michael's dead. Bob's still alive, I presume, at least last I heard. And I told him, Gene, that I'd like to see a copy of a diploma. I'd like to see a listing in an alumni directory. He says he has a master's degree. That means he wrote a thesis. Who was his thesis advisor? There should be all kinds of evidence. And so I sent him copies of my diplomas. Most people still have their diplomas. I sent him listings in the directories of the American Nuclear Society and the American Physical Society and the University of Chicago Alumni Directory. Trivia, if you will. I never got anything back from Gene. I talked to five different people at MIT, the physics department, the legal counsel. I asked, is there any way you could wipe a guy's record clean, which was the claim about Bob. There's no way to do that. You're in too many places. He said I had a master's thesis. He got a master's degree. That means you need a thesis. I talked to the people who gather theses, or whatever the plural of them is, and it ain't there. I talked to Los Alamos. Now, if you have some evidence, why don't you put it on the table? Send it to me at P.O. Box 958, Houlton, Maine. You don't need to cross the border. Houlton, Maine, 04730-0958. I would love to see some evidence from the people who claim all kinds of things have provided nothing. Do you have a copy of a diploma for these guys?
Yes, I do. Matter of fact, I do. I have all that stuff in my files, and I'd be glad to share that with you. Also, you're the guy that Dr. Wolf sent a piece of metal to, and you said it was just nothing but...
Never sent me a piece of metal. Sorry about that.
Oh, yes, he has. Yes, he has, Stanton. And you know what? You're just about as bogus as that Dan Burrish is.
Oh, okay.
We agree that Dan Burrish is bogus. If you don't, provided my credentials.
Time out. We're not going to do personal attacks. Okay, we can attack the story. We can attack the evidence. We can call it into question. That's fine. But personal attacks, we're not going to do them.
Good.
Okay. Thanks for the call. 1-800-289-1092. 1-800-289-1092. That's the telephone number to call. It's toll free. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you have a question? Do you have a comment? The subject under discussion originally was and should still be flying saucers and science. You said something about fusion rocket engines.
Yep.
Now, when we think about fusion, we obviously think about the H-bomb.
And we think about, you know, a little packet of material doing huge, huge damage. How could you harness that and control it so that it is usable for a rocket?
Well, people need to look up a study that was done at Aerojet General Nucleonics back in the early 60s under the direction of John Luce, L-U-C-E. He had headed the fusion program at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, gave papers at international symposia, invented the Luce arc, as a matter of fact. If you use the right stuff in the right way, you, for example, use heavy hydrogen, which is deuterium, and helium-3. If you react, there are a whole bunch of fusion reactions, I better say here, many more types than there, say, are fission reactions. And you pick the right fusion reaction, you get charged particles, which are nice because you can accelerate them in a certain direction with electric and magnetic fields. If you use the reactions that people are trying to use to produce power on Earth, then you use deuterium, the heavy hydrogen, and heavy hydrogen, and that gives you a lot of energy, but it's mostly in the form of neutrons, which are a pain in the neck because they go off in all directions, and you can't control getting them all out the back end of the rocket. With the deuterium and helium-3, you can kick them out the back end. And 10 million times as much energy per particle as you get in the dumb old chemical rocket.
Well, now, that certainly would give a great explanation for or a justification for going to the moon to harvest helium-3.
Well, the moon or Jupiter, and some people say other places in the solar system. We won't know until we get there, but. Yeah, helium-3, Mother Nature provides that you can do it in nuclear reactors, but look, heavy hydrogen, deuterium, heavy hydrogen. Yeah, there's a lot of it around, but you got to gather one part in 6,000 of the hydrogen in the ocean. You know, H2O, well, one in 6,000 of those is D. But our Canadian nuclear reactors, for example, use heavy water as a moderator. That's D2O instead of H2O. So you set up a big plant, and you separate the hydrogen isotopes. And, you know, if I'd said that, 70 years ago, you'd have said, I'm nuts. What do you mean, separate the isotopes? We spent a lot of money separating uranium isotopes during World War II in the Manhattan Project, and also separating hydrogen isotopes. And so it can be done if you set your mind to it and got a huge budget. Doesn't come cheap. Once you've got it, then okay. We got a bunch of reactors up here that use heavy water as the moderator, which would have been inconceivable before heavy water was discovered, before deuterium was discovered.
So it's a real possibility now. Let's go back to the phone line.
Yep.
And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, my name is Marty. I'm from California.
Hi, Marty.
Hi. Very nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
And I'm a first-time caller.
Oh, well, you know what goes with that. Here we go. Got a little applause going on here. All right. What's on your mind, Marty?
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Friedman, I
yes.
just wanted to say what how refreshing it is to hear you on this program and to be able to talk to you.
Good.
I wanted to ask a couple of questions that you might think are just basic dumb questions, but it's something I can't quite get off my mind because I've studied this for years. And one is regarding the UFOs, which I think it's pretty obvious that, yes, of course, they are there, and I think it's pretty obvious that we are being visited from things that are outside this Earth. The question I'm asking is about some UFOs that a lot of people are claiming are military craft that have been back engineered by the military in the United States and possibly other countries, but predominantly the United States. And I was wondering, what do you think about that?
And, let me say also, I hate to butt in, but we're a minute and a half away from a break, and both of you, if you'll just hang on, we'll flow over the break.
Thank you, Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think some UFOs are certainly government developed vehicles. Whether any of them come from back engineering crash saucers or studying the behavior of uncrashed uncrashed saucers, I don't know. But I would point out, if you'd given Christopher Columbus a nuclear submarine and an unlimited budget and said, I need two more of these, he couldn't have built one. So these, if these guys are, you know, a cool 1,000 years ahead of us, as opposed to what might be a billion, I think some of them, when I say this in the book, are from Zeta Reticuli, and those two stars, Zeta 1, Zeta 2, are a billion years older than the sun. They could have one heck of a head start on us. So we wouldn't know how to develop the technology. I think we're trying. Of course we're trying. It's one of the reasons for secrecy, because not only do we want to get there first, we worry about somebody else beating us to the punch. There are sightings all over the planet, and apparently crashes in many places, some of them probably from our attempts to shoot.
Hate to do it. The break is on us, and we've got to back out of here. We'll be back right after this.
Talking on the phone, that's how you really want me, that I'm the one you love. I said, oh no, you're too first love. Love is just a word to put a ball and chain on me, to shape and change me to what you want me to be. I said, oh no, you do first love. I've been down this road before, scared to take the trip again. So don't be making plans, 'cause I know what's at the end. I said, oh no, you be making plans, 'cause I know what's happening.
Kevin Smith Show has been broadcasting to the world since 2000. Our audience has grown from zero to audience in 70 countries, making it one of the hottest shows on which to advertise. Put the power of the Kevin Smith Show to work for your own business. Advertising on this show is definitely one of the hottest ways to expose your business to the world. Request your free media kit right now and put the sizzle of this show to work for you today. Send your request to addinfo@kevinsmithshow.com. That's addinfo, A-D-I-N-F-O, @kevinsmithshow.com. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steeline Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com.
Call Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
All right, we are back. And, caller, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Sorry I had to cut us off, but actually I didn't. The automation software does that. Okay, Stanton, I cut you off in mid-sentence.
Well, I think that we're doing our best to figure out how they might work. But what we need to take into account is the huge amount of money that's spent in the United States on research and development activities. I've said this before in the program, but when I was working on nuclear airplanes back in 1958 for General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department, we were spending $100 million a year, employed 3,500 people full-time, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. That was a lot of money in 1958. You know, where you might start work in industry at under $6,000 an hour, $6,000 a year with a master's degree. You don't need more. So we have to recognize that if you put enough people on enough programs, you're going to get some progress. The stealth fighter, $10 billion, 10 years, and we got one. And there have been all kinds of black budget programs. We're talking huge amounts of money. You know, the average professor might think of a big project being six professors and 15 grad students. It ain't nothing compared to, well, the three nuclear weapons labs. I checked about 3 years ago. They each had an annual budget of over a cool $1 billion, and each employed more than 8,000 people. That was several years ago. So what I'm saying is that we expect there to be new systems developed. We're phasing out the F-117, believe it or not, the first stealth fighter. It's being replaced by a better model. So I'm not saying we haven't learned anything from observing saucers. And as a matter of fact, in the book, Saucers and Science, I have a picture of me taken many years ago standing next to an Apollo command module. I gave a talk to a bunch of NASA people in Southern California. And the point is, when you stand next to it, you realize how much more like a saucer it looks than what I thought a high-speed airplane ought to look like. You know, pointed nose, sharp wings, and so forth. Maybe the idea to build a blunt body came from somebody doing a wind tunnel test, and we know some were done back in 47, of round, disc-shaped craft. And son of a gun, look at that. Lift the drag, all the other good features. So, One thing that makes a research and development program more likely to succeed is that knowing what you're trying to accomplish can be accomplished. The Russians at the end of World War II knew that atom bombs could be built. We had exploded by 1947 at least five of them. And so if the first one doesn't work, you try again. Hitler didn't know that during the war, so he didn't spend a lot of money on nuclear weapons. He spent a lot of money on rockets because he knew you could build them. So what I'm saying is, I have no doubt that we're trying all kinds of new systems. If you wanted to get research and development money, make it for a military application, and the money was there, especially during the Cold War. We spent huge amounts of money. I'm not saying we should have. I'm just saying we did, like it or not. So I won't rule out that we've back-engineered some stuff, but I don't think it's anywhere as near as easy as people would like to think it is. For example, the theory of a nuclear bomb is pretty straightforward these days, but you need fissionable material. I mean, unless you can bribe a Soviet guard who isn't getting paid enough, who's guarding such stuff, you got to make it yourself. It's expensive. It's not easy. So the theory is easy, the practice is difficult.
Okay, caller, you said your name is Marty?
Yep, that's correct.
Marty, we got just enough time for you to ask your second question, and Stanton, you'll have to keep it short. We're almost out of time.
Thank you, Doug. Okay. I'll make it one quick. Okay, given that the aliens are here and seem to be playing a lot, an awful lot of peekaboo with people kind of here, there, and everywhere, and I'm wondering, why are they not making themselves or their purpose known to average people?
Well, because obviously that's not their intent. I don't talk to the squirrels in my backyard, and they don't usually talk to me either. On my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, there's an article on the UFO why questions, and that's one of them. You know, and in fact, why don't they land on the White House lawn? Or why would they come here? And I have a whole chapter in the book dealing with that. What's special about Earth? Obviously, they know we know they're here. When you've been followed on radar umpteen times, you know the other guy knows you're there. What do you need to talk to him for? Are we worth talking to? And, you know, why don't they land on the White House lawn? The President of the United States, site, to tell you this, doesn't speak for 6 billion Earthlings.
Right.
I know that'll surprise you, but...
Yeah.
What?
Okay.
All right. Marty, thank you so much for the call.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right.
Good call.
We have a flash message from Australia that I want to get in before we run out of time. This is from Tony in Australia, and he says, I firmly think SETI has made many contacts, but like usual, we will never know. As for observing UFOs, I've seen quite a few now, and I can tell you I am neither mad nor do I have poor eyesight.
Good. Well, then he ought to be interested in my book, and you can get it through my website with PayPal, www.stantonfriedman.com. Simplest thing, send me a check, and you'll get an autograph, too. $19, Post Office Box 958, Holton, Maine, 04730-0958. It's on Amazon, it's at Barnes & Noble, but you don't get... autographs with those, you know.
Yeah. Are any of your books available in ebook format?
Well, yes and no. UFO TV has the ebook rights to the books published by my publisher, New Page Press, which includes Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience by myself and Kathleen Marden, Betty's niece. That just came out last year and has done quite well. And they have the rights to the new book, Flying Saucers and Science. Whether they've actually manufactured any e-books or not, I don't know. We'll find out. But that's been thought about. And, you know, it's the new world of coming. And it's interesting that New Page also has published a book by Dr. Edgar Mitchell and by Jim Mars and other interesting people. Obviously, the public is interested in this subject.
Oh, they're very, very interested. And in fact, earlier, we played an ad that encourages people to advertise their businesses on this show, and it says we're in 70 countries. That's a few months out of date. We're in 95 countries.
Wow, I'm impressed.
Yeah, we're in 95 countries now. So, are people interested in these topics? Well, I think the proof is in the pudding. Yes, they are. Very interested. Worldwide. And I'll tell you something. Now, we're out of time, but this thing in Vietnam?
Yeah, I just read it. That's an interesting article.
It's fabulous, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, they just really did a fine job of straight reporting, and that's as it should be. I want to thank you for being with us again. It's always fascinating, and I hope you'll be with us in the future.
I hope so, too.
All right.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
Good.
And I didn't mean to cut you off. Are you still with me?
Yeah, okay. I guess he's not. But I pushed the button a few seconds too soon. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's a wrap. We've got to call it a wrap for tonight, and we'll be back tomorrow night. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.